Today, the parents of Michael Brown, the African-American shot by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, filed a wrongful death lawsuit against that city, Police Chief Thomas Jackson, and Darren Wilson, the officer who shot Brown. Meanwhile, in Cleveland, Ohio, the sheriff continues to investigate the police shooting of 12-year-old Tamir Rice. Today, our series, Tracking Race Relations, called Tracking Lincoln, takes us to Cleveland as we follow the route of the slain president's funeral train 150 years ago. It traveled through cities like Baltimore and Philly on the way to Springfield. On April 28th, the train pulled into Cleveland.
Punctually, at 7 o'clock, the funeral train arrived at the Union Depot on the Lakeshore track. The streets were almost totally blocked up with the immense crowds.
Part of an article published the next day in the Cleveland Plain Dealer and read here by the group Cleveland Historical. The president, of course, was known for his effort to keep the Union together during the Civil War and for the Emancipation Proclamation, which called for the end of slavery. As Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd reports, Lincoln's legacy is still relevant in Cleveland.
150 springs after President Lincoln was carried into this city, the trees are blooming pink as candy in the park where Tamir Rice was killed by police.
It just doesn't feel right. It's just uncomfortable to sit here and, like, all his teddy bears and candles are, like, right there. It's so close.
Angelique McGuire is a high school student who lives a few blocks from here. We're at a park table memorial for the 12-year-old who was shot in November. Tamir was playing with an airsoft pellet gun. A police cruiser pulled up, and seconds later, he was dying. The officer said he fired as Tamir reached for the replica pistol in his waistband.
I feel like I'm in a movie, honestly, truthfully.
5 months later, the wound is still fresh for Samaria Rice. Her son and that park have become symbols in this country that represent the chasm between police and the black community. Last year, it was Tamir Rice in Cleveland, Eric Garner in Staten Island, Michael Brown in Ferguson. Now it's Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina, Freddie Gray in Baltimore. Rice says getting added to that list was a jarring experience.
I was actually pushed in this situation that I'm definitely never was prepared for. It's difficult. It's a lot of days that I really don't know how I'm going to get by, but the comfort of knowing that there is a God out there kind of keeps me focused and settled in my mind.
When you see these new cases coming out in other cities, what do you think is going on in this country?
Sometimes, I don't want to really think that it's racism, but, I just keep seeing the same thing over and over again, and I'm wondering, where are they getting these officers from? Like, where are they coming from? I mean, are they passing a test?
People were asking questions about police in Cleveland before Tamir Rice was shot. In December, the Justice Department issued a scathing report that said inadequate training and lack of accountability led to a pattern of excessive force. Mayor Frank Jackson says the scrutiny will lead to lasting reforms. Here he is at his State of the City address this year.
This challenge, to me, is a major challenge, but it is what we do as a city. Cleveland is used to hard times. Hard times is what we do.
By the end of the year, the city says all 1,500 of its officers will be wearing body cameras. Police have received further training in first aid, CPR, and crisis intervention. And the city says it's searching for an independent monitor to keep tabs on the department as part of its agreement with the Justice Department. But it's not enough for Samaria Rice. She says she's waiting for the officers involved in her son's shooting to be punished. And that investigation is still ongoing.
That's where it will start with me. I don't care nothing about no money. I'd rather have my son before anything. I need a conviction. And that's where my healing process will begin.
This is a 12-year-old boy. It's hard to heal from this.
The city's Blaine Griffin runs Cleveland's Community Relations Board. He's been busy smoothing distrust between police and residents. Like many cities across the country, Cleveland's police force is not as diverse as the community it serves. And Griffin says the tension isn't just about one shooting.
Cleveland is just a microcosm of America.
He says it's about disparity in economic opportunity for people who live in different parts of the city. Differences in access to health care. Differences in education.
We see this as something to make us look at ourselves in the mirror and see how we can look at these endemic problems of race and bias. We see this as an opportunity.
What do you think, 150 years after Abraham Lincoln, what do you think he would say if he visited Cleveland today?
I think Lincoln represented exactly what's going on in America today. How do you take people with different philosophies, different mindsets that are all part of this great country that we call America and create the most perfect union? So I would think that Lincoln was saying that the work is continuing on building that perfect union. We're not there yet. I cannot be cocky to say that we'll ever get there, but I can say what Lincoln would say that's going on now is that people are still making America, making Cleveland, making our city a perfect union.
I asked that same question to Daisha Acevedo outside her home on Cleveland's west side.
He wouldn't be proud of what he was seeing in my community. I don't know about this, but not in my community.
Acevedo is a 20-year-old college student and a volunteer for a group called the New Abolitionist Association. This neighborhood is mostly Latino and low-income, and ever since the shooting, Acevedo says she's changed her behavior. She's careful at night not to wear hooded sweatshirts. She keeps her hands outside her pockets.
Something's different about the way when I go out in the streets.
But Acevedo is also hopeful. Since the Rice shooting, her group has been calling for broader police reforms and tougher civilian oversight. Acevedo uses her love for music and poetry to help young people voice their frustration about what's happened here.
Hold on just a little while longer. Hold on just a little while longer. Hold on just a little while longer. And
hold on, she says. Change is coming. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Cleveland.
And everything's gonna be all right.
France's prime minister said today the country has thwarted 5 terrorist attacks since 2013, including one that authorities say would have targeted churches and was stopped on Sunday. Security has been stepped up in France since the attacks in and around Paris in January that left 20 people dead. The BBC's Lucy Williamson joins us from Paris. And Lucy, what more do we know about the attack that was thwarted over the weekend?
Well, it seems to be a rather strange situation in that this attack appears to have been thwarted almost by accident. The suspect in the case managed to shoot himself in the leg. It's not entirely clear how, but investigators say they're not ruling out the fact that he may have shot himself. He then called the emergency services, who called the police. And when the police got there, they found a trail of blood that led to the suspect's car. So they looked inside and they found a stash of weapons, they found the sort of flashing lights that you see on top of police cars. And so that, of course, made them suspicious. They then carried out an investigation of his student accommodation. They found Kalashnikovs, they found more police-style uniforms, equipment, and that led to the current investigation. So he's now been taken into custody. The slight twist in the story is that his DNA was actually found with a woman who appears to have been murdered in her car just outside Paris that same day. So he's linked to the murder of this woman. He's also linked to this plot to attack churches, apparently with the stash of weapons that the police found.
And they believe that he was acting in coordination with other people.
They do, yes. They found documents inside inside his apartment, which the Interior Minister, Bernard Cazeneuve, said proved, A, that he had intended to target one or two churches in France in the imminent future. Secondly, according to the Paris prosecutor, that he had been in touch with both, had links to both Al-Qaeda and Islamic State, and he'd been in contact with someone inside Syria. And it was this contact inside Syria, the prosecutor said, who had advised him to target churches here in France.
What about the overall threat? We're hearing from the French Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, that the government has prevented 5 terror attacks since 2013. Is there a heightened state of alert right now in France?
there's certainly the feeling that France is facing perhaps an unprecedented threat, certainly a new kind of threat. Radical Islamist groups like Islamic State have specifically targeted France in their messages and their exhortations to followers. So France is definitely on high alert. Now, of course, everyone remembers the fatal attacks here in January when the offices of a satirical newspaper, Charlie Hebdo, were attacked by radical Islamists, also a Jewish supermarket. Many people died. And since then, France has paid particular attention to guarding places of worship like Jewish centres, schools. And in fact, already the government here has said they'll be expanding that kind of special close protection to also protect Catholic churches in the wake of this new threat.
The BBC's Lucy Williamson joining us from Paris. Lucy, thank you.
Thank you.
A while back, we made our way past the practice rooms at Berklee College of Music in Boston in what would become a trip back in time. A guest lecture by famed album cover photographer Henry Diltz.
So here's the Crosby, Stills, Nash cover.
It's getting to the point where I'm no fun anymore.
We've added the music there on the wall behind the legendary photographer, the photograph that graces their first album. Sitting left to right on an old couch on an equally well-worn porch, Graham Nash, Stephen Stills, David Crosby. In the wrong order.
They were in the middle of their first album. They didn't have any photos of them. So we drove around, we found this old house, and they sat on the couch. We took these pictures. Then later, wait a minute, we decided to call ourselves Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Now, I said, let's just go back. And we went back, and the house was gone, bulldozed all the way to the back of the lot.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
Now here's Joni Mitchell, who was one of the Laurel Canyon people. She lived on Lookout Mountain, down the hill from where I lived. She needed publicity pictures.
There are a number of pictures of Joni Mitchell. You can either conjure them up or follow along at hereandnow.org. She's leaning out a window, staring at the camera with blue eyes. Then there's the picture Henry snapped of some shady guy at a Halloween party.
There was a guy hanging out. Nobody knew who it was, and Joni Mitchell.
I was always interested in capturing exactly what my eyes saw. I just wanted it to look just like that.
Well, because you wanted what you saw, what you have is a history. You have history.
Well, yes, which was surprising to me. I mean, I never once thought at the time, boy, someday I will have all these pictures. I never thought that. It was just a daily thing. It was a part of life. It was something that I just did every day, you know.
Oh, to live on Sugar Mountain with the barkers and the colored balloons.
Here's Neil Young. This is a morning walk around his farm, and he bought part of Lionel Train's. His son is disabled, and he really loved running the trains with a special switch. So Neil invested heavily in Lionel trains. And he devised special cars, like a cattle car. You know, in the old days, you push the button and it goes, "Rrr." Well, Neil recorded his herd of cows. So when you push the button on his, it was a moo, "Rrr, rrr, moo." Here's Paul and Linda. Any of you people songwriters? Well, I witnessed something really great that day. They were sitting around the pool, and his little daughters were swimming, and at one point they held hands and jumped in the pool together, splash. And without missing a beat, he just started singing, "Two little sisters jumping in the pool." This little tune just drifted up into the air, and I thought, wow. There's, you know, a McCartney song that nobody will hear. And then about a year later when that song, "Who's That Knocking at the Door?" I know he was sitting in the living room with his feet on the coffee table with a guitar. And somebody knocked on the door and he said, "Who's Someone that knocking at the door?
Somebody ringing a bell. Someone's knocking at the door. Somebody's ringing a bell. Do me a favor. Open the door and let him in."
We take a break. Berklee teacher Peter Payak brings in pizza.
Okay, come get pizza. Thank you so much.
And I wondered, why are these 20-somethings so loving Henry Diltz's pictures and the music from 40 to 50 years ago?
My name's Michael Goodman. I'm 21 years old.
So do any of these images resonate with you? Have you seen them before?
I've seen actually a lot of these before. I was raised on this kind of music. It's not going to be so long from now that people like this aren't going to be around to tell us these stories. So getting a chance to hear them firsthand is really nice.
Then there's Samantha Berezina, who also saw all these covers growing up.
I'm having trouble comprehending it, honestly. It's crazy to just see them in such a casual setting when I've listened to their music my entire lives and, like, hear casual stories about them.
Does this music mean something to you? I mean, yes, it means something to you in a nostalgic way because your parents had the albums, but does it resonate for you?
Yes. I love everything about Joni Mitchell. She's one of my favorite female powerhouse singers. I adore everything she's ever done.
Case of you. I rest my case.
I drink a case of you, darling, and I would still be on my feet. Oh, I would still be on my feet.
And we all went to the army together, right? Because in my neighborhood, when you're 17, right, the cops come to your house.
If you go to the army, I go to jail.
Da-da-da.
It wasn't just music acts. Henry Diltz photographed people for magazine covers, and he did comics like Richard Pryor.
He said, well, if I do anything, it's got to be something rootsy with authentic sort of Aborigine weapons and stuff. So Richard knew where this little cave was up in Beverly Hills, and went there. He became that native. I mean, he was protecting that cave with his bow and arrow, and it looked so much like National Geographic.
What about the album art? You talked about the Richard Pryor album. Some would say that is a lost art.
Well, the art of the 12-inch square is lost because that, you know, album covers were a 12-inch square, and it was a beautiful art form to design on, and people would stare at those for hours. It was an automatic thing. You put the record on, and then you just stare at the picture while the music is going on. Then they shrunk to those little bitty CD covers and kind of lost that, but they're kind of coming back. You know, groups are insisting on having 12-inch vinyl albums. You know, people collect those old ones and put them on their wall. Yeah, it's a very interesting art form.
Ooh, witchy woman, she got the moon in her eye.
For the Eagles' first album cover, the band left the Troubadour in L.A., traveled all night to Joshua Tree State Park, climbed a mountain in the dark, and shot As the Sun Rose, High on Peyote.
You know, this was 1972, but they, you know, their idea was if it was 1872, they probably would have been gunslingers. And if they hadn't had guitars, they probably would have had six guns. We went out there with real cowboy clothes, real guns with blank ammunition. And these guys just went into a time warp, you know, and played cowboys, and they were shooting each other and rolling in the dirt and, you know, having a great time. And pretty soon we heard fire engines. And from all this shooting and all this gun smoke was rising in the air, and somebody thought the hills were on fire and called the fire department. Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? Well, Don Henley had written a song for a friend of his who had gone off the deep end, and the song was, for God's sake, Leo, why don't you come to your senses? And then they changed it into Desperado.
You've been out riding fences for so long now.
You know, I often say being a photographer is like having a passport into people's lives. You know, you end up in places, you know, that you, it's amazing, you know, that you, being a fly on the wall. Here is Tina Turner. Here's Garth Brooks. Here's the Morrison Hotel.
I'll keep your eyes on the road you held upon the wheel.
The Doors' iconic cover was shot in an old hotel that band member Ray Manzarek spotted in downtown L.A.
This old funky hotel. It's at Morrison Hotel. It's a derelict hotel. Look at rooms, $2.50. So we walk in the lobby. Nobody's in the lobby except the guy behind the desk. And I say, well, we're just going to be over there shooting a couple of pictures. And he said, no, no, you can't. And the guy left the desk. And I said, quick, run in there, you guys. And we took one roll of film and got out of there. Jim Morrison was a poet, you know. He was an observer. It wasn't like the movie with Val Kilmer. In fact, the first time he played on stage, he turned his back to the audience. Jimi Hendrix was like a little kid. He was such a simple guy, you know.
And up on the screen pops Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock.
Okay, that is remarkable.
Yeah, fantastic.
At the end of the presentation, the Berkeley students crowd around Henry Diltz, and a budding photographer shows him her work.
Was
that you at the piano, or did you?
Probably my camera wasn't that great, so you know, like the resolution probably not enough.
Well, I mean, look, you're zeroing in, you're filling the frame, you know. It's like when you teach little kids to draw. You say, you know, you draw it all the way out, fill the paper, you know, with the picture. So just your job is to get yourself in those positions so you can take the pictures, you know.
And then one last Henry Diltz photo of the class.
Everybody give the peace sign. Okay. Now, everybody give the finger.
Okay.
Legendary album cover photographer Henry Diltz at Peter Payak's Berklee College of Music class. To see every album cover we talked about and more, and to order prints, go to hereandnow.org.
A House committee in Texas has approved a bill that bans state and local funds from being used on marriage licenses for same-sex couples. This comes just days before the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments challenging same-sex marriage bans. And it comes as a new poll from ABC News and the Washington Post finds a new high of 61% of Americans in support of same-sex marriage. Joining us now from Austin is Bobby Blanchard, reporter with the Texas Tribune. Bobby, welcome.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm doing well. So tell us more about what this bill said.
So what this bill does is it does not allow state or local funds for issuing same-sex marriage licenses. And in addition, it says that all county clerks must send fees collected for marriage licenses to the Secretary of State. And the Secretary of State can only return those funds to counties which do not issue same-sex marriage licenses.
But why is that something that lawmakers felt was necessary, given that same-sex marriage is not legal in Texas?
So this timing is important here. I mean, next week the Supreme Court is going to be hearing challenges to same-sex marriage bans. And I think lawmakers are starting to feel like they need to do what they can, what they want to do to try to preemptively prevent same-sex marriage from happening in Texas. What the author of this bill has said is that the intent is to assert the sovereign rights of Texas over the federal government in terms of issuing and licensing marriage.
But would a bill like this hold up in court if same-sex marriage does become legal in Texas by order of the Supreme Court?
Right. I don't believe so. It would definitely be a challenge. It would definitely be something that would be discussed, and it could even delay same-sex marriage in Texas. But I think it would not ultimately win. Of course, this is just one of many bills that lawmakers in Texas have filed this session to try to preemptively prevent same-sex marriage from happening here. Another one would take away the salaries from government employees who issue a same-sex marriage license. Another bill says the Secretary of State is the only person who can issue any kind of marriage license. Another bill would amend the Texas Constitution to say that same-sex marriage is not allowed regardless of whether or not a federal law or a federal ruling says so. So there are several bills that have been filed this session to attempt to kind of preemptively prevent same-sex marriage from coming to Texas. And this is the first one to pass a committee, which is why it's kind of significant.
And is that reflective of attitudes among the population in Texas? Are people that strongly against same-sex marriage in general?
Right. Well, this is a very conservative state, and this is a very strongly conservative-held Texas House and Texas Senate. I mean, the Texas Republicans are in the majority in both the House and the Senate by long runs, and many of them have ties to the fall religious right in Texas. That definitely has a strong influence on legislation that passes in Texas. But same-sex marriage has been getting more and more support in Texas. A Texas Tribune poll from October of 2014 showed that 42% say yes, 47% say no, while 11% kind of don't know. So same-sex marriage has been slowly getting more and more support in this state. It's nothing compared to what's happening nationwide, mind you. Nationwide, the support is much stronger than it is in Texas. But support for same-sex marriage in Texas has substantially grown in the past few years.
That's Bobby Blanchard, a reporter with the Texas Tribune. Bobby, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Because of a government loophole, big farms are getting taxpayer dollars they haven't necessarily earned. And as Abby Wendell of Here and Now contributor Harvest Public Media reports, closing that loophole is not easy.
The federal government pays farmers billions of dollars a year in farm subsidies. The payments are meant to stabilize the food system by supporting farmers during tough times. The idea is to keep food plentiful and relatively cheap. The Farm Service Agency regulates these payments, and in order to qualify for a check, you have to meet the FSA's definition of a farmer. Levi Grohl fits the definition. On a sunny Saturday afternoon, he's in his barn sporting Carhartts and work boots caked in mud.
There's multiple branches to farming. You have to be a mechanic, weatherman, and then work in the dirt, planting something.
Grohl farms full-time in western Illinois, growing row crops, raising hogs, and solving problems.
Yeah, come on!
We'll start.
For farmers like Grohl, the FSA's guidelines are clear. Own land or equipment or invest in the farm? Check. Do 1,000 hours of labor a year? Double check. But not all farmers are so obvious. Some look more like businessmen, and they're eligible for subsidies, too. The FSA calls this group farm managers. What's farm management?
Well, that's the big rub.
Craig Cox is with the Environmental Working Group, a watchdog group that tracks farm subsidies. He says the FSA's current guidelines for management are too loose. Some managers spend just a few hours a year working on farm business.
This loophole has made a real estate agent in Chicago that makes a couple of phone calls a year eligible for farm payments.
It's called the actively engaged loophole, and it's been gaping for nearly 30 years. The FSA currently limits payments to $250,000 a year for a farmer and his spouse. Most farms never come close to hitting that ceiling, but some large farms do. And that's where the loophole problem comes in. Bumping up against the limit, add people to the payroll, and the limit rises.
Some farm operations organize themselves so that there's sometimes 10 or 20 people that are considered providing active personal management and therefore eligible for farm subsidies.
The Government Accountability Office tracks government spending of taxpayer dollars. The GAO investigated the loophole. It concluded that the FSA's loose guidelines make it easy for big farms to collect big payments while doing little farming. For example, one GAO report cites a family farm in the Midwest that received $400,000 in subsidies in a single year. Among the 11 recipients were a 16-year-old who was allegedly helping run the business and an 88-year-old whose permanent address was in South Florida.
We're proposing a rule that tightens up that loophole and really makes it much clearer around who can receive a farm payment and who cannot. And we feel like it's a strong rule.
Val Dolcini heads the Farm Service Agency. He says his agency is proposing new rules to close the loophole. He says farms would be limited to a maximum of 3 managers. Managers would have to do at least 500 hours of work a year, and they have to document it. If the FSA adopts these rules, Dolcini says they could save taxpayers $50 million over the next 3 years. But that's just a tiny fraction of total subsidy payments.
I'm disappointed. This really does not accomplish what I want to accomplish.
Chuck Grassley is the senior senator from Iowa. He authored the amendment that instructed the FSA to close the loophole. But he says the results don't go as far as he'd like. The issue? Congress exempted family farms from the rules. And family farms make up about 97% of all farms in the country. So do you think that now it's kind of like the family farmer loophole?
The answer is yes. They gutted it. So it probably is going to apply to 1 or 2% of the farmers.
How much money are taxpayers losing to this new loophole? The FSA doesn't have an estimate. Senator Grassley says if he's still in office when the next farm bill comes up for reauthorization, he'll try again to close the loophole. For Here and Now, I'm Abby Wendell.
And now let's see how other stories are coursing through social media. Mike Barry is social media producer for The Guardian in the U.S. Mike, what's jumping out for you?
Well, we had a really interesting story that resonated on social media yesterday, the story of a man named Bertrand Olotara. He is a cook for the United States Senate, and he went on strike yesterday and wrote a commentary piece for us urging the president to sign an executive order mandating a $15 an hour minimum wage for government employees and contractors.
Well, actually, we have some sound from your interview, The Guardian's interview with Bertrand Olotara, an immigrant from the Republic of Congo who, as you said, works as a cook in the Senate. Let's listen.
I'm a divorced father, 5 kids, and I work 7 days a week, 60 hours a week, 240 hours a month. When you compare it to people who work at Costco, they make more. And I work in the Senate building, one of the prestigious place in the world.
And Mike Barry, we should say that those 60 hours are not all at the Senate. He also works at Whole Foods. Your paper estimated that he made about $36,000 last year. He's also paying off student debt from his bachelor's degree at Strayer University and raising 5 kids. This was part of a general strike, wasn't it? A Senate workers' strike? What's been the reaction online?
It really resonated with readers on Facebook. There was just a tremendous amount of shares going on, and it actually sort of emanated from Facebook onto traditional cable news channels as well, CNN, CBS, and MSNBC. What I think really strikes readers in this story is how it relates to the larger Fight for 15, which we saw protests with fast food workers last week, and a general sense and part of this larger discussion that people are having about what is a living wage, what is government's role in creating regulations that lead to that. And beyond that, what I thought was really interesting about this piece was that Mr. Olotara was directing it right at the senators, some of whom are running for president of the United States, and saying, if you can't take care of the people who work for you in the Senate cafeteria, how can you take care of all of these people that you promise you're going to bring the American dream to? Oh. And I think that that was a really clear way for people on social media to understand the plight of this man and how it resonates in their own life.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that story now. What else? Give us one more you're seeing resonate on social media.
Something that I think was really interesting was a story that the New York Times has been covering about Parma, Missouri. There is a new mayor in Parma, Missouri, Tyus Byrd. She is the first African-American mayor in Parma's history. And once she became mayor, most of the city staff actually resigned, several members of the police force, as well as a couple of administrative staff as well. While they are stating that it's about police safety, some people on Twitter particularly are focusing on how this relates to a general sense that the police and there's a rift between police and African-American communities. Mm-hmm. The thing that I find really interesting about this and how people are talking about it on Twitter is that they're basically filling in the blanks. While the police say that it's really about their own safety, Tyus Byrd herself says she doesn't really know why they resigned. And people are using this as another example of the kinds of racial tensions that exist between police and the African-American community around the country. And particularly because this story is coming out of Missouri, with all of the discussions that we've been having over the last several months with Ferguson, I think that it just adds another boost to the idea that there is a regional problem that also speaks to a larger national issue that people really want to talk about right now.
Huh. Everything's going to be looked at through that prism. And we should say the new mayor, Mayor Byrd, also said she never encountered any black-white issues in Parma, but we'll keep an eye on that story as well. Well, I think we need to end on a light note, and we have one. President Obama visited Jamaica, the first U.S. presidential visit in more than 3 decades, and said this to a group of students at the University of the West Indies.
Greetings, massive. Hey. Wagwan, Jamaica.
Greetings, massive. Wagwan, Jamaica. It means what's going on. Mike, what happened?
So essentially, there was a vine that came out of that with the Wagwan Jamaica that several different musicians and rappers remixed and turned it into kind of a hip-hop musical extravaganza that pushed that story into like the pop culture sphere.
Well, we've been listening to one version. Many Jamaica dancehall artists took it. This is Bombs Away. Mike Berry, social media producer for The Guardian in the U.S. Wagwan.
Wagwan to you, too.
Netflix announced this week that the 90s hit Full House is coming back in a sequel dubbed Fuller House. It will include some of the original stars, though not all. And Full House is just the latest in a parade of old favorites that have been returning to TV lately. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now with more on this. Eric, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So Full House coming back as Fuller House 20 years after it went off the air. And so far it's been confirmed for 13 episodes in this new season. But how much do we know at this point about the show?
Well, we know one of the biggest names from the show, John Stamos, is going to be an executive producer on the show. And there's going to be some of the sisters from the show and a next door neighbor will be on. But some of the biggest stars that, you know, went on to do other things from this show, people like Bob Saget and Lori Loughlin and the Olsen twins, they have not yet agreed to do it. I've seen at least one story with the Olsen twins where they said they found out about this by the press announcement. So I wonder if Netflix isn't hoping that the publicity of the fact that they're reviving the show may push some of these stars who haven't yet agreed to do it into agreeing to do it so that they can have a more complete Full House reunion here.
But is it worth doing the remake if they don't have all the old stars?
Well, I think it all depends on what story they're going to tell. I mean, the most important thing that these remakes can do is offer some sort of new reason to exist. It can't just be about, boy, I wonder, you know, what the Olsen twins look like when they're growing up, or, boy, wouldn't it be great to see John Stamos on TV again. There has to be a creative reason to do the show that will, you know, make people, especially people who weren't necessarily huge fans of the original, want to watch the new one.
I'm still getting over the new Darren on Bewitched, and that wasn't even a remake.
You are seriously dating yourself, my friend.
Hey, Nick at Night, my friends, Nick at Night. But this is not the only remake here of an old show. We've got Arrested Development, obviously, on Netflix, Coach, Bewitched, The X-Files, Boy Meets World, which is now becoming Girl Meets World. Why are so many networks doing this right now?
Well, one thing, you have, of course, a very recognizable name when you decide to reboot or reinvent or bring back a show. Fox had some great success last summer with returning 24 to the air after it had been off the air for a while. And I think there's a sense, particularly with this X-Files reboot, that there's a ton of fans out there who would be really interested in seeing a new show with the old characters. And in an era where we have so much TV product out there, and so much TV product that's good, it really helps to have a show that the audience already knows and that has very recognizable stars in it who, in the case of The X-Files, for example, they may not have done a lot of network television since they were originally on their show. And so this is a chance to bring them back to network television in a splashy way with a recognizable show.
Recognizable. So they are going after the people that watched the show in the first place. They're not trying to get new audience?
Well, one of the things that you pointed out so astutely is that you have these platforms like Nick at Night, or you have Netflix, that has introduced some of these shows to younger generations. So I think there's a sense that maybe there's an audience of millennials and maybe even younger TV watchers, and they may be just as excited to see a new version of the show as the people who were watching the show when it was originally on.
Or they could be disappointed. They could watch this and think, this is nothing like the original. This doesn't bring me back. This just makes me feel not right about this show.
People disappointed by the derivative nature of television? What are you talking about? That's not possible. No. Well, you know, as I said, the key is whether or not they have a reason to bring back the show. When I heard that FX was going to do a version of Fargo, I, like many other critics, said, oh my God, this is terrible. People love the movie. Why would you do a TV version of it? But they had a creative reason. They had a great story. They had great new characters. And they had great ways of calling back to the movie for people who were serious fans of the film and could really appreciate it. So that is the thing you want to hear, that they have a great new story to tell. And now now they can wrap the nostalgia and create a great new series.
Does this also tell you, though, and you're somebody who's come on this show and said this is the golden age of television right now. We've got so much that we don't even have time to watch that's on TV right now, new stuff. Does this tell you that they're running out of ideas and that they have to go back to the old things?
The network's running out of ideas? What I think, again, it's not about running out of ideas. It's more about when you take your shot with these shows, you're spending a lot of money. And I think it's easier for a network executive to go into a meeting and say, okay, we're going to spend $5 million to bring The X-Files back to TV. And everybody gets excited about that, rather than saying we're going to spend $5 million to create this new show by somebody that maybe you've never heard of. Now, maybe that new show is going to become the next Breaking Bad, but it might be easier to pitch a known quantity, and it's certainly easier to pitch it to advertisers.
That tells me that those board meetings where they're making these decisions, they need Tom Hanks' character in Big in there saying, no, let's make a bug out of the they need somebody young in that room. NPR TV.
Yeah, exactly.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thank you so much as always.
Always a good time.